you, dear.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. When we learned that our original speaker that we lined up, you know, a whole year ago, John Bolton, would be a little too busy figuring out how to send missiles to Syria or whatever, my first thought was to quickly find a replacement to talk to us about another very timely topic. And my first choice was Bob Levy, because I knew that he could do just that. Now, you've all read Bob's impressive bio, I'm sure. But I like to tell you some things that maybe were not in the bio. For example, you might not know, he's a jazz pianist, an avid hiker. He was a two-time Marine Corps marathoner, pretty impressive. And now, of course, he's best known for his expertise in constitutional law. But that was his second career. You know, he didn't even go to law school till he was in his 50s. Boy, talk about reinventing yourself. And then, this is kind of a cute story. He clerked for two federal judges, and he's the only law clerk who is older than both of the judges he worked for. But every time he went into the courthouse, he looked very distinguished and older. So he told me that when he arrived each morning, the marshals who were standing guard there treated him with great deference, and they would say each morning, "Good morning, Judge Levy. Have a nice day, Your Honor." And, of course, he never corrected them. I mean, who would? And it wasn't until he entered chambers that he was told to go fill the water jugs in the jury box. Now he's going to fill us in on the latest developments regarding a very important part of our Constitution. Please give a warm welcome to the chairman of the Cato Institute, our good friend and member, Bob Levy.
Thanks very much, Corinna. It's great to be with you. It's very encouraging to hear and recognize the students from our local high schools. It actually gives me a real sense of hope that for the next generation. Now, I suppose that the internet and iPads and computers have sort of revolutionized education, but interestingly, there's a new study that says that students who write out their own class notes instead of using a computer are more likely to learn the material. There's also a study indicating that students who pay for Xerox copies of their friends' class notes are more likely to become chairman of the Cato Institute. So needless to say, it's a disappointment for all of us that John Bolton couldn't be here. He is certainly an important and provocative public figure. Since I'm substituting for John, I feel obligated to say something about foreign affairs, even though I've had very little experience in that area. Truth be told, I've had only one foreign affair. And that was many years ago. Of course, I had to maintain my reputation, so I paid $130 in hush money. Given my prominence and stature, that was $130. So on advice of counsel, that's all I'm going to say about foreign affairs. Instead, what we are going to discuss is gun control and the aftermath of Parkland. And I plan to cover four topics. First, a quick summary of what the Supreme Court has said about the Second Amendment. Second, a recap of the data on gun-related violence, hopefully without getting mired in a swamp of conflicting statistics. Third, I'll be examining the various gun control proposals. And fourth, taking a look at where we go from here. There was one widely cited survey just reported in the papers indicating overwhelming support now for additional gun regulations. But I think it's fair to say those surveys are notoriously unreliable. Back in February, there was a poll that showed that 60% of Americans favored a referendum on impeachment. And then a later poll a couple of weeks later showed that 65% of Americans didn't know what a referendum was. So let me begin with the Supreme Court's key Second Amendment case, and that was District of Columbia versus Heller. The case was filed in 2003 by me and by two other attorneys on behalf of six law-abiding residents who wanted to possess a functional firearm to defend themselves in their home. So the Heller case was not about machine guns. It was not about so-called assault weapons. It was about the right to own ordinary garden variety pistols in the home for self-defense. As you may know, off and on over the years, Washington, D.C. had reclaimed its title, not just the nation's capital, but the nation's murder capital. The D.C. government had been totally ineffective at disarming violent criminals, but they have done a superb job of disarming the decent and peaceable residents of Washington, D.C. Essentially, no one in the district could possess a functional firearm in his own residence. So thanks to the Heller case, the D.C. gun ban was repealed. The court declared that the right to bear arms is fundamental. That's a term of art. When a right is fundamental, the burden shifts to government to justify any restrictions. So it would no longer be up to me to show that I had a need to carry a gun. It would be up to the government to demonstrate that it had a need to limit my access to a gun. Now, that said, nobody believes that gun rights are absolute. So clearly the Second Amendment does not guarantee the right of an 11-year-old to carry a machine gun in front of the White House when the president is taking a stroll on the lawn. There are some weapons, and there are some persons, and there are some circumstances that is going to be subject to regulation. And that is the same framework we have for other constitutional rights. For example, the First Amendment, if you read the First Amendment, it says there should be no law abridging the freedom of speech. No law, pretty clear. And yet we have laws preventing incitement to riot, lying in commercial advertising, defamation, and on and on. So neither the right to free speech nor the right to bear arms is absolute. They can be regulated, even though both of them are constitutionally guaranteed. So what about the impact of the Heller case on these multi-victim killings like we had in Parkland, Florida? Heller concluded that the Second Amendment secured an individual right to bear arms in common use for lawful purposes. But Justice Scalia, who wrote the 5-4 Heller opinion, explicitly noted that Heller did not, and this is a quote, did not cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places, such as schools, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications, by that he meant background checks, on the commercial sale of firearms. And he also noted there was historical support for prohibiting the carrying of dangerous and unusual weapons. So the state of Florida could have adopted any of those restrictions without violating the Second Amendment as it was interpreted in the Heller case. As you may know, the federal Constitution sets a floor on your rights and not a ceiling. States can always grant more rights than the federal government, and that's what Florida has done with respect to the rights of gun owners. The state of Florida imposes fewer restrictions than would have been allowed by the Second Amendment as interpreted in Heller. Now, by contrast, there are some other states that regulate or even ban, for example, assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, and those regulations have not been overturned by the courts. So it's clear that the right to bear arms is subject to reasonable restrictions like the restrictions that have limited other Bill of Rights provisions, including free speech. But what's reasonable? And that's the question that the legislatures and the courts are going to be addressing. Remember, because the Second Amendment secures a fundamental right, the government bears a heavy burden to show that its regulations will make us safer without unnecessarily compromising the right to bear arms. So that's the background. Now let's take a quick look at some of the data on gun-related violence, starting with the elephant in the room, and that is these horrific school shootings. First, the good news. Since peaking in the early 1990s, gun homicide has declined by half nationwide. Overall gun crime victimization is down by 3/4. School shootings are also down. During that same period, our gun supply grew by 80 million guns. And there's now more than one gun per person in the United States, something approaching 350 million guns. So, guns way up, gun killings way down. The Department of Education reports that 50 million kids attend public schools for an average of 180 days per year. Since Columbine, 19th anniversary today, 200 students over the last 19 years have been shot to death during school. So if you do the math, the likelihood of a given student being killed by a gun in school on any given day is roughly 1 in 614 million. Now, it could be your kid, but he or she faces a much higher risk traveling to or from school, catching a potentially deadly disease in school, or suffering a life-threatening injury playing interscholastic sports. And in fact, there are about 120 times more kids shot outside of school than in school. So it is quite clear that the public tends to overestimate the risks associated with mass shootings. Now, it is true that gun-related statistics present special problems. For example, the data usually includes suicides, which are about two-thirds of gun-related deaths. But if we are examining a ban on so-called assault rifles or high-capacity magazines, suicide statistics are beside the point. No one will be deterred from killing himself because he has access only to a handgun. Also, if we are concerned about crimes using a gun, we have to balance that concern by counting crimes that are deterred by having a gun. And that's tough because guns used defensively are most often brandished and not fired. Still, there are about 500,000 gun crimes each year in the United States. According to Florida State criminologist Gary Kleck, who, by the way, favors more gun controls, there are four times more, that is 2 million, defensive uses of guns. And bear in mind, with 350 million guns in circulation, even if a different gun were used in each of the 500,000 crimes, which obviously is not the case, but even if it were, that would mean 99.8% of the guns are not involved in criminal activity. So let's look at a few of the gun control proposals. For starters, here's one that seems to be self-evident. Keep anyone on the terrorist watch list from having a gun. Well, what seems obvious isn't so simple because of our constitutional requirement for due process. The terrorist watch list now contains about 800,000 names. A smaller subset of that list, the no-fly list, contains about 110,000 names. The lists are secretive, error-prone, unaccountable, and discriminatory. Individuals can be included based solely on suspicion or hunch, and government guidelines actually state, and this is a quote, concrete facts are not necessary. So unless and until we tighten up the list and provide adequate means to challenge and correct mistakes, we should not be arbitrarily denying everyone on the list the right to own a firearm, especially because the practical effect is likely to be negligible. The Government Accountability Office reported 23 million background checks in 2015. Of those, 244 were on the no-fly list. That's 1/1,000th of 1%. And 90% of the persons on the no-fly list are already disqualified from buying guns because they're not citizens and they're not lawful residents. Now, there is some more promising proposals, one of which is that's garnered extensive support to ban high-capacity magazines. I can imagine a Korean shop owner in the Watts riots needing multiple rounds to protect his store and his family, but I can also imagine multiple victim killings, like in Parkland, where innocent lives might have been saved if high-capacity magazines had been effectively banned. So which is the weightier concern? And that's where government has the burden to demonstrate that the benefits of banning high-capacity magazines exceed the costs. And if they do, I have no doubt that a ban would survive a Second Amendment court challenge. But there are a number of problems. First, homemade magazines are very easy to assemble. Second, murderers can easily reload a second or third magazine in a matter of seconds. Third, there's no way to confiscate millions of these high-capacity magazines that are now in circulation. Fourth, there are lots of existing semi-automatic pistols that are configured from the shop for 10 to 15 round mags, so any ban on any size less than 15 rounds would encounter great resistance among gun owners. Now, that said, I am not aware of any situation where an actual or potential civilian victim has fired more than 15 rounds in self-defense. I am aware that magazines with a capacity of greater than 15 rounds have been used in numerous mass killings, and that evidence might be sufficient, and from my perspective is sufficient, for government to justify a 15-round limit on capacity. What about an assault weapons ban? We had one, 1994 to 2004. After it expired, the New York Times reported, and I quote, "Despite dire predictions that the streets would be awash in military-style guns, expiration of the assault weapons ban has not set off a sustained surge in sales or caused any noticeable increase in gun crime." Again, millions of these so-called assault weapons are now used by millions of Americans for hunting, self-defense, target shooting, even Olympic competition. Criminals use handguns. AR-15s are expensive. They're difficult to conceal. And even if we were to reinstitute the assault weapons ban, how would we deal with the millions of these guns that are already owned? Some people think we ought to have a buyback program and that it would work in the United States like it worked in Australia. But it would be costly. And ask yourself, who would the sellers be? They would be individuals who valued the money more than they valued the gun. And for the most part, that would include mostly low-income persons living in high-crime areas who obey the law but need the means to defend themselves. And who would keep the guns? They would be individuals who valued the gun more than they valued the money. And that would include criminals and terrorists and mentally deranged people who are not motivated by financial incentives. In the Heller case, Justice Scalia wrote that the Second Amendment would pose no barrier to outlawing weapons that are not in common use and especially dangerous. So it's clear that some weapons can be banned. Indeed, automatic weapons have essentially been banned since 1934. The task, then, is to identify those semi-automatic weapons that are not commonly used for lawful purposes and would improve public safety if they were banned. The 1994 assault weapons ban went too far, but I think a better crafted and more limited version might well be warranted. What about the clamor to extend background checks to private sales at gun shows? Less than 2% of guns used by criminals are bought at gun shows, and that includes the sales at gun shows that are done through licensed dealers, and those sales are already subject to background checks. So here are some interesting figures for the year that the Heller case was decided, 2008. The National Instant Criminal Background Check System, NICS, called NICS. The NICS system denied that year 79,000 would-be buyers. How many were prosecuted? 105. How many were convicted? 43. Now, that's a conviction rate of 0.05%. So either the remaining denials were legitimate purchases, unjustly blocked by the NICS system, or if the denials were proper, then 99.95% of the 79,000 rejected applicants escaped punishment. Neither of those conclusions offers very much hope for an expanded system of background checks. We would do much better to improve the existing system. Remember that the I in NICS stands for instant. So if technology facilitated truly speedy background checks, say 24 hours max, I would have no objection to extending NICS to cover private sales at gun shows, not because I'm convinced that that process would curb violence, but because it gets us past this particular debate and gets us to address the options that I think might be more effective. One of those more effective options would be to improve reporting on prospective gun buyers who are mentally ill. Currently, federal regulations bar the transfer of a firearm or ammunition to any person who is adjudicated as a mental defective, which means that a court determines he's a danger to himself or to others, or that he lacks capacity to manage his own affairs. That excludes persons who voluntarily commit themselves to a mental institution, as well as persons who are admitted just for observation. President Obama, to his credit, wanted to include persons who are ordered to get outpatient treatment. That seems reasonable to me, as long as there's a process to restore gun rights when the person is no longer deemed to be a public safety risk. Now, there's a bigger drawback to the NICS system, and that is that many states have not provided mental health data to the system. And the Supreme Court has ruled that the federal government cannot compel compliance by the states. Maybe, post-Parkland, the states will be more cooperative. Of course, there is a more effective solution, and that is earlier detection and treatment of mental illness. I'm certainly no expert on mental health, so I can't offer specific recommendations except to make the obvious point that greater scrutiny of medical records raises certain civil liberties issues that have to be addressed, involving, of course, privacy rights. The NRA has suggested a different approach to stopping deranged gunmen, and that is have armed guards or even armed teachers at schools. Gun-free school zones have been a magnet for the mentally unbalanced, and maybe that's why roughly 28% of schools already employ security officers who carry firearms. Not a bad idea. We have armed guards in banks, airports, on airplanes, in power plants, courts, stadiums, government buildings. There's no reason why armed persons can't be at all public schools, not just 28%. And some of those armed persons could be teachers. No teacher would have to undergo such training. But those who volunteered could be given extensive background screening, psychological testing, plus classroom and practical training, roughly equivalent to what Sky Marshals now get. Teachers would not have to carry firearms, but those weapons would be accessible, subject, of course, to safe storage regulations. Well-trained teachers, some of whom already have military experience, would materially lower the cost of hiring armed guards. Now, the best of all options, which hasn't gotten much public attention, even though it would radically reduce gun violence, and that is legalized drugs. There are 1.5 million drug arrests each year, and more drug inmates than for all violent crimes combined, equal to 50% of the federal prison population. And because the drugs are illegal, participants in the drug trade can't go to court to settle their disputes. So the disputes are resolved by force, on the street, with guns. We have criminals and terrorists earning roughly $40 billion a year in the drug trade. The DEA has thousands of agents and support staff who could be fighting real crime or terrorism. The courts are clogged. The jails are overcrowded. The police are overburdened. Public defenders are overworked. And racial discrimination is endemic. Now, I'm happy to say we're making some progress in this area with state decriminalization of marijuana. It won't be long before marijuana companies are publicly traded, and I predict that investors will be buying high and selling high. Plainly, the war on drugs has been an unmitigated disaster, and one of its pernicious byproducts has been rampant gun violence in our inner cities. So legalization should be a no-brainer. So where do we go from here? Last month, Florida approved a bill that has some useful provisions. It budgets millions of dollars to improve school security, train and arm school employees. It bans bump stocks. Bump stocks convert semi-automatic weapons into illegal automatic weapons. The Florida bill gives the state new powers to remove guns and ammunition from anybody shown to be a threat to themselves or to others. It imposes a 3-day waiting period for most long gun purchases. The bill also raises the minimum age for purchasing rifles to 21. That may make sense, although it is puzzling to me why lawmakers think that an 18-year-old who can legally smoke, sign contracts, get married, get divorced, have abortions, and even vote on who's going to run this country isn't sufficiently level-headed to own a rifle. 21 might well be the right age for rifles, but if so, it's probably the right age for many other acts that require maturity. The NRA has sued to overturn Florida's higher age limit for rifles. My bet, the NRA loses. But even if Florida's new law is upheld, it's just feel-good legislation with little or no practical effect. And here are the FBI statistics for a recent year. Almost 13,000 people were murdered with a weapon. Of those, 1,700 killed with knives, 500 with hammers, bats, and clubs, 700 by someone's bare hands. Only slightly over 300 were killed by rifles, and that's rifles of all types, not just semi-automatics. So before we embark on a crusade for more gun controls, we need to remember a few facts. First, these random multi-victim killings are a fraction of 1% of all the murders in the United States. And sadly, they're going to occur even where strict gun regulations are imposed, like in San Bernardino, California. We had 17 people murdered in Parkland, Florida. There are 17 people murdered in downtown Chicago every 2 weeks. We've had exhaustive studies on gun control conducted by the National Academy of Sciences and the Centers for Disease Control, neither of which is a tool of the NRA. In 2004, the National Academy evaluated 80 gun control measures. Researchers could not identify a single regulation that meaningfully reduced gun crime, suicide, or accidents. The year before, the CDC reported on ammunition limits, restrictions on purchase, waiting periods, registration, licensing. Conclusion, none of the laws demonstrably reduced gun violence. We also should remember that guns are the most heavily regulated consumer product in the United States. Handguns are the only consumer product that cannot be purchased outside the buyer's state of residence. Gun retailers and wholesalers and manufacturers all require federal licenses, and all of their sales have to be pre-approved by the government. Nationwide, there are thousands of laws regulating who can own a gun, how it can be purchased, and where it can be possessed and used. So overall, I am skeptical about the efficacy of gun regulations imposed mostly on persons who are not part of the problem. More important, the Supreme Court has ruled that the Constitution secures an individual fundamental right to bear arms, and that means if gun control advocates believe stringent gun regulations are required for public safety, they have to establish two key points. First, the proposed regulations will in fact make us safer, and second, the same ends could not have been attained without truncating the rights of gun owners. So far, in my view, the regulators have not met that burden. The Second Amendment doesn't preclude reasonable gun regulations. Indeed, I've favored a ban on certain assault weapons, a limit on magazine capacity, and an extension of the background checks. But the Second Amendment absolutely demands rigor from our lawmakers and the courts in crafting and reviewing gun control measures. We have to be sure that the ends justify the means. So that's my story. I'm sticking to it. Dick Bodman suggested that I include something personal in my talk, so I want to end with this very brief anecdote. As you heard from Karna, I was a latecomer to the study of constitutional law, and I was in my 50s when I entered law school. At the time, my wife, Diane, and I were admonished that the all-consuming workload would put considerable stress on our marriage, and might even cause what euphemistically has been labeled loss of consortium. Of course, that warning turned out to be bogus. I did spend long hours studying, but Diane and I were gripped by an urgent passion at the mere mention of the Federal Trade Commission, to say nothing of the thinly veiled eroticism of the Natural Gas Policy Act. Of course, that was back then. That was 27 years ago. Nowadays, when Diane says, "Let's go upstairs and make love," I tell her, "Look, I can't do both." Thank you. But I think I do have enough energy left to answer a few questions. So thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks, Bob. That's terrific. We do have a number of questions here. The first one comes from one of our students. What do you think schools could do to better protect those in the school besides teachers carrying guns?
Well, I think the most important thing is to make the NICS, National Instant Criminal Background Check System, useful. And the one serious defect of the NICS system is the failure to have sufficient data on people who are mentally unbalanced. So that's number one. And there's been a proposal that's been advanced to, as I said, the federal government can't compel the states to comply by furnishing mental health data, and some of the states have been reluctant to do so because of civil liberties concern. But what the federal government could do, and what it does in a lot of other areas, even though it can't require the states to comply, it can tell the states that if you don't comply, we're going to withhold certain other benefits. And there's some law that surrounds the linkage between the benefits withheld and the purpose of the withholding. But as long as that linkage is pretty tight, the federal government could do that and convince the states to comply by threatening to withhold certain other benefits. And I think that's a useful step because the NICS system does not have adequate data on mentally unbalanced people. And I think every one of these school shootings has been where the perpetrator has been mentally deranged in some sense.
Please comment on the pros and cons of permitting guns on college campuses. Same idea.
Well, if somebody has qualified for a concealed carry permit, and most of the states have certain requirements for proficiency testing and passage of knowledge of certain laws, even some, some states they even require some military experience. So there are varying requirements from state to state. But once you've qualified for a carry permit, it's hard to argue that carry permit should only be exercisable in certain locations. I mean, there are some hypersensitive locations where you wouldn't want to have it, like, as I mentioned, outside the White House when the president's delivering a speech. But simply having a firearm on a college campus, if you have been adequately tested and screened, psychologically tested, I think is a step in the right direction. So I think there are pros. The cons are that, you know, anytime you introduce something like this, you introduce an element of risk. So you have to assess whether the costs exceed the benefits. In this case, I would conclude that the benefits are probably higher than the costs, and I think we ought to try allowing carry on the college campuses.
How does gun rights, how does that relate to concealed carry regulations? Some people don't understand what that means.
Again, the Heller case in the Supreme Court concluded that the Second Amendment secures an individual fundamental right to bear arms that are in common use by lawful people for lawful purposes. Bear means carry. So all the states allow concealed carry, or some form of carry, either concealed or open. And the courts have tossed out regulations that restrict all carry, concluding again that because bear means carry, you cannot preclude both open carry and concealed carry. So there are no states that ban concealed carry and open carry. There are a number of jurisdictions, both states and municipalities, that impose conditions on concealed carry. And those conditions vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. As you may know, the NRA has got a concerted campaign going to have reciprocity, such that if you're licensed for concealed carry in one jurisdiction, you're automatically licensed in another. I've opposed that. I've written in opposition to it. I think this should be a matter of federalism, where each jurisdiction sets its own rules. I cannot imagine why the same rules should apply in downtown Chicago that apply in the hills of Montana. So while concealed carry is recognized in all jurisdictions, there are different restrictions imposed upon concealed carry, and it's appropriate for each jurisdiction to determine what restrictions are necessary.
You mentioned earlier you were talking about drugs, marijuana, or legalization, and so forth. Do other developed countries have legalized drugs, and aren't you concerned about their increased use and effect, also particularly on the use by students?
Well, if you ask about other countries, I do have some data actually on Portugal. Now, Portugal in 2001 decriminalized all drugs. Now, that includes cocaine and heroin, not just marijuana. And it's the only EU country to do so. Possession and then use of drugs in Portugal are administrative violations and not crime, so you can't be incarcerated. Trafficking is still a crime there, but not possession and use. That decriminalization process is very popular. There's no demand to recriminalize drugs in Portugal, and most importantly, there's been no adverse effect on drug use. The drug usage rate in Portugal is among the lowest in the European Union. And equally important, these related pathologies, like sexually transmitted diseases and overdoses, have decreased dramatically in Portugal. First, because resources are now available for treatment, and second, because folks feel much freer to come to government for support and for help. They know they're not going to be prosecuted for a crime. So what little evidence we do have about decriminalization in other jurisdictions, I think favors at least trying it here. And, of course, we are trying it with respect to marijuana, medical marijuana in a lot of states, and recreational use of marijuana in some states. And I think, interestingly, there's evidence that cocaine and heroin use has declined in those states where marijuana is legally available. And opioid problems are much lesser in those states that have legalized marijuana. So access to these less harmful drugs tends to dissuade people from seeking out the more harmful drugs. On balance, I think legalization is a good thing.
And follow up, you're not concerned about the effect of students smoking marijuana and being sort of not that much inclined to study hard or to watch where they're driving?
Well, a couple things. First, you know, students smoke cigarettes. Cigarettes have supposedly killed 400,000 people a year. Marijuana, as far as I know, doesn't kill anybody. With respect to driving under the influence of marijuana, we should do the same thing with marijuana as we do with alcohol. And people are prosecuted for driving under the influence of alcohol, and they should be prosecuted for driving under the influence of marijuana. That doesn't mean we ban alcohol. It means we ban driving under the influence. And nor should it mean that we ban marijuana. But if you use marijuana while you're driving and you're driving impaired, you get prosecuted for that.
Okay, switching a bit, why doesn't the entertainment media industry bear more responsibility for gun violence in the U.S. that has such an effect on certain people?
Well, I suppose the reason is a couple. One, free speech. The media is protected by the First Amendment. The First Amendment would preclude the government from clamping down on the speech rights of media. That doesn't mean that those rights are absolute, but it does impose upon government this burden that I mentioned to you. Government has to show a number of things. First, there is a compelling need to regulate. Second, that the regulations are going to be effective. That is, they will accomplish what they're intended to accomplish. And third, that the same ends couldn't have been achieved by means that are less violative of Second Amendment rights or any other rights. And government, in my view, has not met that burden in most cases.
Okay, this is a question not about guns at all, but as a constitutional expert, different issue if you don't mind, what is your opinion of the government's seizure of Trump lawyer Cohen's files and the relationship to attorney-client privilege?
Well, the two exceptions to attorney-client privilege are, first, if the material is being used in the furtherance of a crime or fraud, then they're not subject to attorney-client privilege. And second, if the lawyer himself is the subject of the investigation, then, any communications indicating what the lawyer has done as contrasted with what the client has done, is not, those communications are not subject to attorney-client privilege. Now, whether or not this existing seizure has met those qualifications, I don't think we know yet. The whole story is not yet available, but those are the two recognized exceptions to the attorney-client privilege.
Okay, and this last question. I thought maybe your wife, Diane, wrote this, but she's not here today. So Please explain, what is the Cato Institute, and what is your next book or project? Go for it.
The Cato Institute is a libertarian think tank, the largest libertarian think tank in the world, located in Washington, D.C. We are, if you had to characterize our political philosophy, and I oversimplify because this is a complex issue, I'd say we are conservative on the economic, fiscal, tax, regulatory, budget issues, and we are liberal on social issues, things like the right to gay marriage, drug legalization. We are non-interventionist in our foreign policy. When it comes to the trade-off between civil liberties and national security, we tend toward civil liberties. So we are persona non grata in both conservative and liberal camps. We agree with the conservatives on some issues, with the liberals on others. And if you were to ask how is it that libertarians can be so philosophically inconsistent, our answer is that we are entirely consistent. We want government out of our wallets, and we want government out of our bedrooms. We want minimal government involvement in our day-to-day lives. So it's the liberals and the conservatives who are inconsistent in their view of the proper role of government.
Books?
And I was asked what my next project is to go home and work my way upstairs.
Bob, we want to thank you for having this wonderful speech as our final for the Forum Club. And as tradition, we're presenting you with a book on Naples and one on Marco Island. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.